Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for August 28th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, global ozone depletion by nitrous oxide, using dogs to better understand how social cognition evolved, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about whether multitasking muddles your mind, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Under the Montreal Protocol on substances that deplete the ozone layer, many substances, including chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, are being phased out of production and use. Now, in a paper published online by Science, A.R. Ravishankara and colleagues report that nitrous oxide, commonly known as laughing gas and not covered by the Montreal Protocol, is the dominant ozone-depleting substance, not CFCs. The team calculated the ozone-depleting potential of nitrous oxide as 0.017, which is only about 2% of the ozone-depleting potential of CFC-11. But because there is so much nitrous oxide produced by human activities, the team says it is the most important ozone-depleting gas emitted today and is likely to be so throughout the 21st century, unless regulations curb its use. I spoke with Ravishankara from his office at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Boulder, Colorado.
We looked at nitrous oxide as a potential ozone-depleting gas, calculated its ozone depletion potential, which is a relative measure of stratospheric ozone depleted by this gas for unit emission of this gas to that for a unit emission of chlorofluorocarbon 11. But more importantly, then we compared the total ODP-weighted anthropogenic emission of nitrous oxide with those of CFCs and other ozone-depleting substances. And it shows, based on that metric, that nitrous oxide emissions right now are the most important ozone-depleting gas emissions. And if nothing is done to abate nitrous oxide emissions, they will be the most important one for the next century.
So your team's model of ODP, or ozone depletion potential, showed that nitrous oxide will be the largest contributor to depleting the hole in the ozone for the 21st century?
No. The key difference is not the hole. We are talking about global ozone.
It might make it thinner.
That's correct. It thins the ozone layer.
Okay.
And that actually is a big, that's what started the issue, right? Because that's what would increase the UV radiation across the globe.
Okay. And currently, chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, are the number one ozone depletion potential chemical?
Yes. Currently, what's in the atmosphere from what has been left over from all the things that were emitted a long time ago, in the last few decades. So because of what is left over, chlorofluorocarbons and halons are the largest contributors.
Now, I understand that atmospheric chemistry is incredibly complex and that all these substances are, to a greater or lesser extent, interacting with one another in the atmosphere. So are there combinations of any of these substances, gases in the atmosphere, that are currently having a moderating or dampening effect on nitrous oxide's ozone-depleting potential?
Yes, that's a very interesting question that you ask. Indeed, chlorine itself moderates the effect of nitrous oxide, or flip it the other way, nitrous oxides and nitrogen oxides from it have moderated the effect of chlorine also. So the chlorine, that's the chlorine from the chlorofluorocarbons and the bromine from halons, they together, they're just kind of opposing what nitrous oxide does to some extent. And because they work in slightly different regions, they don't completely offset each other, but they do cancel a part of each other's effects.
So as an example then of one type of moderating effect is as you remove more and more chlorine from the air by eliminating these chlorofluorocarbons or by not emitting them anymore, the moderation or dampening by this combination of chlorine and nitrogen oxides goes away.
That's correct.
And nitrogen oxides then could potentially have an even greater impact.
Yes. In fact, we calculated what would be its ozone depletion potential if the chlorine level in the atmosphere were to revert to the levels that were before chlorine was a concern, the level of 1959. Okay?
Okay.
Then the effect of nitrogen oxides would be larger, and the ozone depletion potential of nitrous oxide would be 60% larger than what it is today, 0.017. So the ozone depletion potential would be 0.026.
Now, how about the rate of nitrous oxide emissions in the 21st century? How have those changed?
It is increasing. Overall, it's increasing at a rate of about 0.25% per year.
Where is it coming from?
It is coming from a few human activities, the major one being agriculture, where fertilization leads to the production of nitrous oxide. And the other source is combustion. And there are a few other sources, like some chemical processes that produce nitrous oxide.
And how does nitrous oxide rate as a greenhouse gas and contribute to global climate change?
Nitrous oxide is also a greenhouse gas. It also absorbs outgoing infrared radiation. And let's say methane would be a good comparison. You know, the metric used for global warming potential is how does nitrous oxide compare with carbon dioxide. So it's roughly 300 times more effective, 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide in terms of its greenhouse gas potential, or global warming potential, as it's called.
So reducing nitrous oxide gas emissions would be helpful for both the ozone layer and greenhouse gas emissions.
That's correct.
Any projects for sequestration of nitrous oxide?
Not that I know of for nitrous oxide. Nitrous oxide, unlike carbon dioxide, has a very diffuse emission. It's not, you know, coming out of little tailpipes as easily. So, for example, in agriculture, it's all over the place. So the kind of methods one may have to use would be different. So sequestration is something that I do not know about.
A.R. Ravishankara, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A.R. Ravishankara of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is lead author of a paper on nitrous oxide as the dominant ozone-depleting substance emitted in the 21st century. Read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Have a dog? Do you think your dog is smart? Would you like to have your dog participate in a cognitive experiment? In this week's Science, freelancer Virginia Morell reports on the growing trend of researchers conducting experiments with dogs to help better understand how social cognition evolved. I spoke with Morell from her home office in Oregon.
This is a story about how scientists are looking into the minds of dogs and finding out what they think. We're dealing with a species, as with most animals, that we can't actually ask questions of by using language, so we have to find alternate means to get inside their minds. And so scientists have been coming up with a lot of very clever tests to find out what dogs think about the world, what they think about us, and how they've changed from their ancestors, the wolves.
What, if any, advantages are there for researchers in studying dogs instead of other animals?
Well, the interesting thing is it used to be thought that dogs weren't an advantageous animal to use. People didn't want to use them because they were considered artificial animals. That is, that because we had domesticated them, that we'd taken them from a wild animal and made them into an animal, if you will, that wants to live and be with us, that somehow made them not real. And what's now been shown is that actually the very things that people used to criticize as reasons you wouldn't want to use dogs are actually really advantages. And the main one being that because we know dogs' ancestors, they are the gray wolf. And all dogs today come from the gray wolf. So because of that, we can do a lot of comparative studies looking at how dogs behave and then how wolves behave and comparing the two. And we can perhaps see some changes. That's one of the things that geneticists are working on, to look at how the genetics of dogs have changed from their ancestors, the wolf. There are very few species where you actually know what their immediate ancestor was and can do these kind of comparative studies with. We can do it with ourselves and chimpanzees, for instance, but for a range of other animals, that's not possible.
So the idea then is to look at the evolutionary roots behind dogs' social behaviors?
The evolutionary roots, both of their social behavior, of their cognitive abilities. In fact, Darwin even suggested this, you know, that you can take an animal like that and actually see the evolutionary processes that they underwent to become the animal that they are today. And again, you know, it's one of the things that people look for and search for in the wild are examples where you can actually see what an animal is like today, look at what its ancestor was like, and try to understand what changed in the genome, which sites, that kind of thing. And it's very, very difficult to do that. Most often all you have is the fossil record. Here we have the living animals. We have the gray wolf. We have the dog. We have a variety of other canine species, canid species, that we can look at and do the same kind of both genetic and behavioral cognitive tests and analyses.
But is that social behavior, the cognition of dogs, really an evolutionary change, or is it learned behavior? I mean, we have wolves that can be socialized, even tamed, and dogs can become wild, and there are wild dog packs.
Yes, in fact, those have been in the news recently, and that's something that I did not address with the researchers. You know, the development of these wolf dog packs, why that comes about, what happens, what causes the break between man and dog. But have they changed? Well, yes, obviously. You know, Adam McClosey, one of the researchers I spoke to, said that the thing that he tries hardest to get across to people is that it is not a wolf that you have sleeping at the end of your bed, that you wouldn't have a wolf sleeping at the end of your bed, that we have made the dog into an animal that is properly, you know, socialized from the time it's a puppy. They yearn to be with people. From the moment they open their eyes, they will choose a human over a dog. And that is something that's quite extraordinary. You know, wolves do not do that. That's not an innate behavior in a wolf, but it is in a puppy. And so how different are they from wolves? Researchers like Adam McClosey would say extremely different. And you can see it, I think, primarily just in that attachment, the fact that they want to attach to people, and it's their choice.
Are those the kinds of tests then researchers are doing to test whether domesticated dogs, domesticated wolves, if you will, are evolutionarily more in tune with people?
Yes, they've done this. That's one of the tests that they've done. They have taken a number of wolves. In this case, they were working with European wolves and raised them more or less as you would a young puppy. I think they raised them up to about 4 months. But early on in the testing, and again, I'm not sure exactly how old these puppies were, but they were very young, maybe 4 weeks old or so, both wolf and dog puppies. And if you put the dog or the puppy just on the floor and in the distance some meters away, you put a human on one side and a dog on the other, and the puppy or the wolf cub is allowed then to choose which individual it's going to go to, human or dog, the puppy will always, always choose the human. And the wolf, it's either or. It doesn't seem to really matter to it. Just, you know, it's sort of interested in either one. And there have been a number of studies, you know, people will say, oh, well, wolves are smarter than dogs. And they are, apparently, in terms of figuring out the physical world and how things work. There have been various tests with various things that you have to do physically, and a wolf can look at a particular kind of setup and figure it out in an instant, and dogs won't do that. What they do is that they will look at their human and ask essentially for not so much assistance as cooperation. Let's do this together. We're going to do this together, right? You know, I mean, that's the kind of mind that a dog has. It's a cooperative mind. It's a collaborative mind, and wolves are much more independent. So the question then is, what has changed? And that is something that geneticists are now looking at.
Okay, so with dogs as a model, is there some particular aspect of the evolution of social cognition that researchers are hoping to learn about from studying dogs?
I think what they're particularly interested in is this evolution of cooperation, because when they look at other species, for instance, chimpanzees, which are our closest ancestor, they don't see cooperative behavior. What they see instead are animals that, unless they are social equals, they cannot work together on a task. If they have to, for instance, both pull a rope at the same time in order to lift a board and get a treat, if the animal that they're working with, if the other chimp they're working with, happens to be lower in the social hierarchy, they cannot both pull the rope. There has to be a fight. And, you know, I mean, it's just many, many demonstrations of that over and over again, of this lack of cooperation unless they are social equals. Now, what we've done as people is that we've found a way to cooperate with many, many other individuals, not just within our family, but outside of our family. The fact that you and I are having this conversation, you know, is a really excellent example of the kind of cooperative nature we have. And what we have done with dogs is to make them part of that collaboration that we like to have with other individuals.
Virginia Morrell, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you too.
Virginia Morrell reports on a growing trend of using dogs to help understand how social cognition evolved. Speaking of dogs, in a paper published online by Science, Elaine Ostrander and colleagues report that the variation of a dog's fur, or coat, is governed by just 3 genes. The team performed a genome-wide association study of more than 1,000 dogs from 80 domestic breeds to identify the genes associated with dog fur phenotypes, or how the fur looks. So whether a dog's fur is fluffy, curly, wavy, kinked, long, short, wiry, smooth, silky, and so on, just 3 genes can account for 95% of the variability of the dogs sampled. The researchers say the work illustrates that a whole array of varied and seemingly complex phenotypes can be reduced to the combinatorial effects of only a few genes. Read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Now, Michael Torres, sitting in for David Grimm, is here with a selection of stories from Science Now, the online daily news site of science, including one story about multitasking and whether it muddles the mind. Michael, what do researchers mean when they say multitasking muddles the mind?
They're wondering if people can ignore distractions and switch their mind between different tasks quickly.
So the researchers gave them some tests to try this out?
Yes, they gave them 2 tests. One was looking for them to filter out information about 2 different rectangles, a red rectangle and a blue rectangle. And they were asked to only focus on the red rectangle and say what's changing with this rectangle through each picture. But they found that a lot of the heavy multitaskers were much slower in picking out the changes than the lighter multitaskers.
So these were people who were doing this specific task. They weren't multitasking while doing this task. And the heavy multitaskers were just slower at it.
Exactly. These are tasks that are testing features that you need to do when you multitask. You need to be able to filter out extraneous information. And they were looking at whether or not these heavy multitaskers were better at filtering out extraneous information. And it turns out that they're actually worse at it.
Now, by heavy multitasking versus light multitasking, what's the distinction?
They asked these people to sort of self-report, how often do you simultaneously text or play a computer game or watch TV? And they sort of separated people by this sort of questionnaire.
Okay. And you said there were 2 different tests. What was the second test?
The second test was sort of more of a look at how quickly could people switch between different tasks. So they were given a pair of a letter and a number. And then they were either asked whether or not the number was odd or even, or if the letter was a consonant or a vowel. And so they kept switching between these tasks. And once again, the heavy multitaskers were less able to sort of switch between these tasks quickly than the light multitaskers.
So is it that heavy multitaskers are less able to filter and stay focused, or instead that people who are less able to filter and stay focused are more likely to be heavy multitaskers?
That's a good question. Actually, an outside researcher wonders if this is sort of a chicken or an egg situation where maybe people who have poor attention skills are actually more prone to multitasking than those who can keep their attention fixed more steadily. So what the researchers sort of find is this ironic result that the people who think they're really good at multitasking and do it a lot are actually not able to do the sort of mental things you have to do when you multitask.
And how much slower are they in general than the light multitaskers in performing these tasks?
So on average, in the filtering task, the heavy multitaskers are about 100 milliseconds slower than the light multitaskers. That doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're multitasking, say, while you're driving a car, that could be a huge difference in avoiding a pedestrian that jumped in front of the road. So pretty important.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
So another story about confusion is, do people actually walk in circles when they're lost in a forest? You kind of hear that cliche, oh, we've been walking in circles for hours. Well, is that actually true? And so this was asked in a German science TV show called Kopfball, which means head ball in soccer. And the producers asked scientists at the Max Planck Institute if this was true, and the scientists didn't know, so they decided to test it on the show.
What different hypotheses did they test?
Well, first they wanted to test was, does this actually happen? And so this is an example where you couldn't do this study without GPS. So they blindfolded a bunch of volunteers, strapped them with a GPS receiver, and told them, try to walk in a straight line.
So they could track their movements, essentially, from space.
Exactly. They're able to then see how these people sort of randomly meandered across a field, and they found that they did, in fact, walk in circles sometimes, and these circles could be as small as 20 meters in diameter.
That's a pretty tight circle. What did the scientists hypothesize accounted for that?
So they wondered if people had sort of a strong leg that was kind of biasing them towards going to the left or to the right, but they actually found that people randomly went left or right, independent of how strong their left or right leg was. And they even gave these people thicker-soled shoes on one foot to see if they could kind of push them in one direction or another.
By making one leg longer than the other.
Exactly. But they found that, again, there was no bias to the left or the right when they gave them these thicker-soled shoes. So instead, they think that maybe as you're walking around, you're taking in all this information from your balance systems, from your muscles, and you're trying to organize all this information on how to continue to walk straight. And there's little errors in this information. And those errors build up, and eventually that makes you go in one direction repeatedly until you form a circle.
So it doesn't happen every single time. It just happens sometimes.
Right. Some of their walking was just sort of random, no apparent shape or size.
And this is while people were blindfolded?
Exactly. They were blindfolded, but they also did a test where people weren't blindfolded. They put them in a forest they'd never been in and asked them again to walk in a straight line. And they found that when the sun was out, these people could walk perfectly straight. But when it was cloudy or overcast, they actually would start walking in circles again. So they're saying that these visual cues, like the sun or shadows in the forest, help people orient in the right direction.
So it sounds like there's some practical advice then to this study.
Yeah. If you're lost, wait for the sun to come out.
Okay. So last one. What's this last story about?
So here's a story about lightning going in the wrong direction. And so back in 2001, people had discovered this upward moving lightning. So these are called gigantic jets that go from the tops of the clouds to the top of the atmosphere, the ionosphere. But they've been very poorly characterized because they're kind of elusive phenomena. So when in 2008, when Tropical Storm Cristobal was off the shore of North Carolina, these scientists decided that this was a great opportunity to try to capture these gigantic jets in action. So they set up these cameras to take movies of any possible upward lightning. And the videos that they recorded showed this lightning sort of exploding like fireworks setting off, going up towards the top of the atmosphere.
So by having a picture, what did that help researchers understand about this lightning?
Well, it first showed that this lightning looks like lightning that goes between the clouds and the ground. And they actually set up other equipment that could measure how much charge was in this lightning. And they found that it was equivalent to normal lightning. And so basically scientists didn't know whether or not this lightning was going to be just a trickle of charge upwards, or was it going to be a full-on sort of jet of charge. And they found that it was the latter, a jet of charge going up about 90 kilometers into the atmosphere.
Very high, then.
Yes, almost the top of the atmosphere. But the curious thing is, unlike cloud-to-ground lightning, which takes about a microsecond to form, this upward lightning takes 30,000 times longer to form.
Why is that?
They think that it's because above the clouds, the atmosphere is much less dense. It takes longer for the charge to build up.
So really curious weather phenomena.
Yeah, so next time there's a big lightning storm near you, you should look for lightning that's not only going to hit the ground, but also lightning that's going up into the atmosphere.
Okay. Well, thank you, Michael.
And thanks, Ron.
That's Science's Michael Torres, sitting in for David Grimm, with a selection of stories from Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is the letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
Our first letter this month highlights a regulation put into effect on May 1st, 2009 by the Chinese government, titled Rules on Punishment for Violation of Laws in Statistics. Chengguo Liu of Beijing Forestry University and Hong Yang of the Swiss Federal Institute of Aquatic Science and Technology write in support of the new regulation.
The authors write, "Particularly in the current financial crisis, many countries rely on statistics released by the Chinese government for production and trade of bulk commodities, exchange rate, and economic stimulus. Statistical corruption has been found in China for years, largely for two reasons.
First, the authors write, economic growth is a key factor determining the promotion of government officials. Statistical data and numbers are regarded as a reflection of economic growth, which is used to evaluate the performance of officials. This is the so-called numbers make leaders phenomenon. The second reason is the so-called leaders make numbers phenomenon.
The statistical organizations are not independent entities in China, the authors write. They are a part of the government and hence are vulnerable to government interference. Without specific laws and regulations to punish statistical corruption, government leaders can intervene in statistical reporting with low political risks. They may tailor statistics for different purposes, such as inflating statistical numbers that indicate economic achievements and decreasing statistical numbers for environmental pollution and damage.
The authors write, "The previous statistics law in China has been in effect since 1983. But it was too vague to enforce. The new regulation is an important step in the fight against statistical corruption in China. Nevertheless, to eradicate illegal acts and statistical work, further actions are needed, such as reform of the evaluation system for officials and the establishment of independent statistical organizations. Without progress in these areas, the goal of an 8% GDP growth rate for 2009, announced by the Chinese government, could be merely another number created by leaders."
You can read the full letter in the August 7th issue of Science. Our next letter also comes from that issue and is about how organic food isn't necessarily nutritionally superior to conventionally produced food. Kate Clancy from the University of Minnesota, along with colleagues from Minnesota, Michigan State University, and Cornell University, write in to point out the evidence that there is no meaningful difference in nutrient levels.
Furthermore, the authors write, "Almost all reviews and much of the original research report only the statistical significance of the difference in nutrient levels, not whether they are nutritionally important." The authors do stress that there are potential public health and environmental benefits from organic foods, including low pesticide residues and reduced soil loss. But, they write, "supporting unsubstantiated claims of nutritional superiority is an unwise and unnecessary argument for promoting dietary change. For now, we urge scientists, producers, and others not to mislead themselves and the public."
Our final letter this week is from our Life in Science series and was published in the August 21st issue. Patrick Keeling writes in from the University of British Columbia to describe how a high school lecture on creationism got him excited about science.
"On that fateful day," Keeling writes, "all the science students were herded into the school auditorium, where we listened to a long and richly illustrated lecture describing literal creationism. We were informed that in an effort to balance our education, we would soon hear an equally long lecture on evolution. This, like many things I heard that day, turned out to be false. The evolution lecture never materialized. Remarkably, I graduated from senior biology, having learned only about creationism."
Keeling continues, "School had finally gotten my full attention. I wanted to know what we were missing and why. For the first time in my life, I willingly, eagerly even, picked up my textbook and studiously read it. With growing interest, I realized that evolution made an awful lot of sense and that I was being hoodwinked by my biology class."
It's hard to overestimate the appeal of rebelling against the system to a teenage boy, Keeling concludes. And that day marked the beginning of my path to a career in evolutionary biology. We learned other things in science class that year, too. For example, that all actions have an opposite reaction. For at least one sulky teenager, it took a creationist to make him into an evolutionary biologist.
Find a copy of Keeling's letter in the August 21st issue of Science. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the August 28th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.